Wednesday, October 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with just 3 weeks to go, President Trump and Joe Biden zero in on the states that could make or break their chances of winning the presidential election.
We're going to win a lot of states, big.
Let's get up. Let's take back this country. Show the world who we are.
Despite tensions with the White House, the top U.S. infectious disease doctor says he's staying put.
I'm not going to walk away from this outbreak, no matter who's the president.
Also ahead, a big award for his kindness for a musician named Killer. It's all on today's International Edition. With just 3 weeks to go before Americans vote for the next commander-in-chief, President Trump is ramping up his campaign schedule after being sidelined with COVID-19. On Tuesday, Trump traveled to the battleground state of Pennsylvania for his second campaign rally since his illness.
I went through it. Now they say I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there. I'll kiss everyone in that audience. I'll kiss the guys and the beautiful women and everybody. I'll just give you a big fat kiss.
Democrat Joe Biden held two events Tuesday in the key state of Florida, where the polls show a very tight race.
No matter what, don't let anyone discourage you or tell you your voice won't count. It does. It will. You are the American people, and you will decide our future, not Trump.
Joining us from Florida is VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman, who covered the Biden events.
His first event was targeted at seniors, of course, a very vote-rich constituency in the state of Florida, where, according to an average of a number of major polls, Biden is leading Trump by about 4.5%. But that's very close to the margin of error for polls. So no one in the Biden campaign is saying that they've got Florida in the bag. But of course, Florida, in terms of electoral votes on November 3rd, will be a huge prize, and many people believe that any candidate that could capture both Florida and Pennsylvania and perhaps one or two other battleground states would almost be assured of winning the presidency.
What was the crowd like?
These are a huge contrast to the president's big rallies where there's no social distancing and people are not wearing masks and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people in attendance on tarmacs at airports. Mm-hmm. The Biden events are very much in line with the guidelines of the Centers for Disease Control about having people socially distance, mm-hmm. wearing masks. Trump has mocked Biden for holding these sparsely attended events. Where the guests are all in these circles. And that was definitely the case here. There were several seniors on hand, but the real audience was the one watching the live stream and then the media, which will put the sound bites on radio and television today. So again, the Biden campaign has been really emphasizing all of the safety protocols amid the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, those of us in the traveling media pool who came into the room, we were all wearing our masks, of course, and Biden kept his mask on the entire time. But we were given a second mask to wear, an N95 3M industrial strength mask. In other words, that even though we were wearing masks, they were not satisfied with the masks that the reporters had brought along to the event.
Well, they're certainly making the pandemic front and center as an issue in their campaign, whereas, as you said, pretty much in stark contrast of the president who wants to move on from this issue.
Well, the president, in his remarks on Monday evening, did refer to the coronavirus and his own case of it, but putting the spin on it that he had fully recovered, saying that he's now perfect and that he's also now immune to the coronavirus. Of course, there's no concrete medical evidence of that. On the other hand, we have Joe Biden in his stump speeches blaming President Trump for the 200,000 plus deaths in the United States and saying that there could be a couple hundred thousand more in the months ahead because the president, according to Biden, bungled the response so badly.
Obviously, this is the final stretch of what seems like a very long campaign. We're in the final weeks now, and the president, as you mentioned, says he feels great. It sounds like he's really planning on making up for lost time from being out for about a week.
Yes, 3 weeks to go, Lori, and the president has told his campaign that he wants them to have him doing a campaign event every day. Now, we'll be interested to see if the former vice president, Joe Biden, is able to have a similar pace. The former vice president is doing several events a week, sometimes like he's doing today here in Florida, a couple events back to back, and then returning to Wilmington, Delaware every single night. But every day is going to be critical, especially in the swing states. The Biden campaign feels they've got momentum. They're looking at the polls and seeing that victory is in the path ahead. If they can really maintain these leads, if the polls are indeed accurate, that he is ahead 4, 5, 7, 10% in critical swing states. The Trump campaign knows that they have to find a way to capture the states in which Biden is ahead right now, or the president would not likely be reelected.
White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. The top U.S. infectious disease physician says the United States faces a whole lot of trouble if it doesn't encourage universal wearing of face masks and avoiding mass gatherings. And despite his differences with President Donald Trump, Dr. Anthony Fauci, speaking on CNBC's The News with Shepard Smith, says he's committed to staying the course in fighting the pandemic.
This is an outbreak of historic proportions, the likes of which we have not seen in 102 years. There's no chance that I'm going to give up on this and walk away from it no matter what happens.
Fauci said with a baseline of infections now that varies between 40 and 50,000 a day, he is concerned about the coming winter, which may increase the spread of the coronavirus with more people staying indoors. Johnson & Johnson said this week that it has temporarily paused COVID-19 vaccine candidate clinical trials due to an unexplained illness in a study participant, delaying one of the highest profile efforts to contain the global pandemic. The participant's illness is being reviewed and evaluated by an independent data and safety monitoring board, as well as the company's clinical and safety physicians. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund is projecting a deep global recession because of the COVID-19 pandemic, with global economies expected to shrink by 4.4%. U.S. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett told the U.S. Senate Tuesday she would not bring her own agenda to the bench if she's confirmed to the nation's highest court. In the first full day of questioning from senators, Barrett deflected a range of inquiries on issues impacting a wide range of Americans, from abortion to health care to gun rights. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Day one of 3 days of intense questions from U.S. senators to U.S. President Donald Trump's nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, who pledged not to bring a personal agenda to court cases.
I can't take policy positions or express my personal views before the committee because my personal views don't have anything to do with how I would decide cases.
With each senator allowed 2 rounds of questions this week, Republicans Tuesday praised Barrett as a highly qualified judge whose background as a mother of 7 and devout Catholic would bring a new perspective to the court.
What I want the American people to know, I think it's okay to be religiously conservative. I think it's okay to be personally pro-choice. I think it's okay to live your life in a traditional Catholic fashion and you still be qualified for the Supreme Court.
But Democrats grilled Barrett on a case she could face immediately if confirmed, disputes related to the presidential election.
When the president declares he needs his nominee to secure his reelection, and then the nominee is ran through the Senate in record time during the middle of an election, some are going to question that nominee's impartiality.
I have had no conversation with the president or any of his staff on how I might rule in that case. It would be a gross violation of judicial independence for me to make any such commitment or for me to be asked about that case and how I would rule.
Democrats tried and failed to probe how Barrett would rule on contentious issues, from an upcoming case that could overturn a key provision of the Obama administration's health care law.
I can't express views on cases or pre-commit to approaching a case any particular way.
To declining to say if the landmark 1973 Roe versus Wade abortion case should be overturned, frustrating Democrats.
On something that is really a major cause with major effect on over half of the population of this country, who are women, after all. It's distressing not to get a straight answer.
Barrett's approach to rule based only on the law drew praise from Republicans worried about judicial overreach.
You've got a lifetime appointment, and if you do lawmaking, we can't vote you out of office. Lawmaking's our job. If people don't like what we do, they can vote us out of office.
Polling shows a slight majority of Americans say a Supreme Court nomination should wait until after the presidential election. Yet Barrett's nomination is expected to easily advance to a full vote on the Senate floor by the week of October 26. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
A majority of Western Europeans want the challenger Joe Biden to win November's U.S. presidential election, according to a recent poll by the organization YouGov. The research firm questioned tens of thousands of people on the upcoming November 3rd vote. However, as Henry Ridgewell reports, support for Donald Trump appears stronger in Eastern Europe.
July 2017. Donald Trump and his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, were both in the early months of their respective presidencies. They forged an unlikely friendship, two leaders seemingly far apart on policy, seeking to reaffirm the transatlantic alliance. In the years since, differences on trade, climate change, NATO, and Brexit have put that relationship under strain. Parisians who spoke to VOA hoped for a change of leadership in the White House.
I would like Trump to lose. and I'm not sure he's going to lose because I think he's got many people behind him. I hope that... But I don't know much about Biden.
I don't know if President Biden would be a better president, but I hope that if you have a chance in administration, we can renew normal relationship with the U.S.
A recent poll by YouGov suggests those views are echoed across much of Western Europe. In France, almost two-thirds of respondents wanted a Joe Biden victory, with 16% favoring Trump. Denmark most heavily favored Biden, with 80% against 6% for President Trump. In Germany, over 70% of respondents wanted a Biden victory.
Was hoffe ich?
Yeah. What do I hope for? That they get a new president.
Und wie ich es vorhin gesagt habe, es ist ja, es geht ja auch gar nicht mehr um
It's no longer about an exchange of arguments. Instead, everyone has their own camp. Jeder ist da in seinem, so far apart that it makes me scared.
Und die sind sowas von weit auseinander.
Residents of Barcelona told VOA the election result will likely impact Spain.
We have seen it with Trump, with his trade war with China, his trade war with Europe, and in the end, this affects all of Europe and all of Asia.
In Eastern Europe, there is greater support for Donald Trump. A 2019 poll by Pew Research showed more than half of Polish people had a favorable opinion of the president, the highest in Europe. Trump's decision to boost U.S. troop numbers in Poland has proved popular. Trump has also received praise in Kosovo for his efforts towards reconciliation between Kosovo and Serbia. This billboard on Kosovo's airport highway was funded by a Kosovar national who lives in Sweden.
The reason I paid a giant billboard to President Trump was to honor the American people, to honor the American president. Albanians are the most pro-American people in the world.
Whoever wins, many Europeans believe the U.S. election result will have a big impact on this side of the Atlantic. Interest in the campaigns is growing as the November 3rd election draws near. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Fears are growing of a potential humanitarian crisis as Armenia and Azerbaijan accused each other Tuesday of violating a ceasefire that was agreed to 3 days ago. Turkish-made drones are playing a role in Azerbaijan's offensive in the breakaway enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. Drones have become an integral part of Turkey's foreign policy. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Turkey's drone industry is facing scrutiny from the international community.
Turkish-made drones are
operated by Azerbaijani forces are in the forefront of Azerbaijan's fight to reclaim the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave from ethnic Armenian control. Armenian separatists took Nagorno-Karabakh from Azerbaijan in a bloody 1990s war that killed an estimated 30,000 people. Turkey's vowed support for Azerbaijan in the escalating conflict. Defense analyst Ardar Mevlutoglu says the conflict underscores Turkey's growing reputation as a major drone player.
Turkey has accumulated a large amount of experience and infrastructure to integrate, design and manufacture such advanced drones. Not maybe as sophisticated as United States, but surely being able to compete with Chinese drones. Turkish drones are rapidly gaining technological advantage.
Armenia has condemned the use of Turkish-made drones. Recent reports cite Armenia's military as saying its rockets shot down an Azerbaijani drone near the capital, Yerevan. Ankara has confirmed using drones in support of Syrian rebels and in Iraq against Kurdish insurgents. Turkish-made drones also helped to turn the tide in favor of Ankara-backed forces of the Government of National Accord in the Libyan civil war. Drones are now an integral part of what analysts call Ankara's hard power diplomacy. According to Sinan Ulgen of the Istanbul-based Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies.
Armed drones, electronic war systems has helped Turkey to carry out a more hard power-oriented foreign and security policy, because what it did is it essentially allowed Turkey to rely on its technological edge, which is now allowing Turkey to engage in these cross-border power projection, reliance on hard power, much more than in the past.
But the growing deadly civilian toll in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, blamed in part on Turkish drones, is drawing an international backlash. Canada has frozen the sale of critical components, a move that political consultant Attila Yeshalada of consulting firm Global Source Partners says could expose a vulnerability of the Turkish drone program.
We still can't produce engines. And obviously, we don't have a chip factory, so all the smartware, software in these drones or whatever weapons we're talking about must be imported from the West or from China.
Ankara has criticized Canada's decision. But technology could be on the side of the Turkish drone industry, says defense analyst Mevlutoglu.
It is more than easy to create alternatives. That is the key thing of, or the magic thing about drone technology, because technology itself to develop sophisticated drones has become even more cheaper and more accessible day by day to many more other countries.
In a glitzy video, Turkey recently unveiled what it claims is its most powerful drone to date. Drones appear set to remain not only a vital military asset, but also a key foreign policy tool. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
China, Russia and Cuba won seats on the UN's premier human rights body Tuesday, despite opposition from activist groups who say they have abysmal human rights records. Saudi Arabia, another target for criticism from rights groups, lost. Joining us for a recap is VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
Well, so most of it was preordained before the members of the General Assembly even came into the General Assembly hall to cast their ballots, as it is with many UN elections. And I use the word election loosely, because the way things are done in the United Nations is the member states divide up into regional groups. And then amongst themselves in their regional groups, they divvy up the seats that are available, be it on the Security Council, be it on the Human Rights Council, wherever it is. And then they tend to propose clean slates. In other words, uncontested slates of candidates. So if you have four seats, you propose four candidates and you kind of push them through. It's a way that a lot of countries that may not be so palatable to other countries get onto a lot of bodies. So it's kind of a standard strategy. And in this situation, though, there were four available seats for the Asia Pacific group. And so Saudi Arabia lost primarily because there were five countries running for four seats. states. And you had Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Nepal, China, and Saudi Arabia. Frankly, none of whom have outstanding human rights records. But I think there is a lot of frustration among UN membership with Saudi Arabia because of the long war that they've been prosecuting in Yemen. It has caused the world's largest humanitarian crisis. It cost the United Nations billions of dollars a year in humanitarian aid. And when it costs the United Nations billions of dollars a year, that means it costs the international community because they're the ones giving the money. So countries are fed up with that. There have been a lot of civilian casualties there. The Saudis have been called by name by the Secretary General for killing children with their bombs. They're unhappy with the Saudis for that. So Yemen is a major thing. For Western countries, I think that memory of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident journalist who was living in the United States but had gone to Turkey, and he was lured inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey and killed. I think that memory is fresh in people's minds. Still, it was just the anniversary of his murder recently. And, you know, the Crown Prince has promised a lot of reforms, but he's only kind of paid lip service to it. There's a lot of question about the Saudi position, I think, among countries. But for instance, China, just too powerful. They were going to get on. Pakistan did quite well. Uzbekistan had an authoritarian leader for decades. He died a few years ago. They have a new leader who's trying to slightly, you know, reform the country. I think human rights groups don't think it's happening fast enough, but they made it on. Nepal made it on. But I think just out of that five, Saudi had the least favorable rating, shall we say, among other member states.
There were four Africa seats, too.
There were. Senegal, Ivory Coast, Malawi, and Gabon took those four seats, but they were not contested. And so you have to receive 97 votes in order to get it. So even if it's an uncontested seat, for instance. So if, let's say, Senegal had received 90 votes, they wouldn't have gotten on, and it would have been a problem, and they would have had to figure out what to do. But they all did quite well. And those are countries with reasonably good human rights records. In Latin America, we had Mexico, Bolivia, and Cuba. There have been a lot of questions, of course, raised about Cuba getting on. But they had strong support. They received 170 votes. There are 193 member states. In fact, they had stronger support than Britain or France, which came in with votes in the 160s. But that's often due to their colonial history. A lot of countries who had colonial connections in the past don't tend to vote for countries like that, hold it against them.
Besides the number of votes, are they ever compelled to give an explanation as to why some countries with not so good human rights records will get in while others will not? Or is it strictly by the numbers? Do they ever feel compelled to have to answer to that?
No, and in fact, they will take this and do a victory lap around and use it to legitimize themselves and say, you see, you know, people who say we're bad human rights abusers, it's not true. Look, we just won a seat with X amount of votes on the Human Rights Council. So a lot of human rights advocates complain that they use getting these seats on the Human Rights Council as sort of a shield for some of their own bad behaviors, shall we say. But the Human Rights Council is not a perfect body. Many countries agree about that, but they still think it can do good and that it is needed. And it does, in many cases, order fact-finding, send out special observers or monitors to different situations that might otherwise not be looked into. And it commissions reports. For instance, in the past, we've had several reports on the situation of human rights in Syria, on North Korea, Myanmar, places where they have these independent panels that go and interview people who are refugees, who are in third countries, who fled, and get the real story of what's going on. For instance, with the Rohingya, there was good work done into what happened to these people as they fled from the regime in Myanmar. So it can do good work, but it is certainly an imperfect body. And in fact, 2 years ago, the United States pulled out of it because they were fed up with some of its behaviors and some of its membership.
VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndumbulo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House. VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. Apple unveiled four new iPhones on Tuesday in hopes that demand for higher data speeds will spark demand for new phones. Sales of smartphones have been slowing for years with fewer and fewer big new innovations and rising prices. Joining us to talk about it is Fortune tech reporter Chris Morris. Chris, it certainly wasn't the usual pomp and circumstance with this virtual reveal of the new iPhone 12s.
This was an awkward event for Apple, not only because there was no audience there, of course, and you're used to seeing that kind of screaming Apple faithful whenever a new iPhone is introduced, but also given the state of the world right now with the pandemic raging on and people worried about their jobs, it's a little harder to get excited about an $1,100 rectangle of phone like it was a year or 2 years ago.
So what can you tell us about the four new iPhones that Apple revealed?
There's a wide spectrum of phones that they're coming out with. They start at $699. They go all the way up to about $1,100. So a lot of it is what your budget is. And if that's a little bit high, you can get the entry point iPhone now, the iPhone SE, for $399. So it's not all high-end things. But as far as the new phones, it really comes down to speed and cameras and what's important to you.
All right, the more you spend or the higher the level of the iPhone 12, the faster?
There's always going to be speed. All of these phones are 5G. That essentially means they can tap into the next generation of wireless communications technology. Now, the problem with 5G is it's not real widespread yet. So while it is phenomenally faster than what you're used to on your home internet or your cell phone right now, it's something that you have to be in very specific locations to take advantage of. That's going to continue to spread in years to come, but this is Apple getting in early to sort of establish a base as that continues to spread.
What's new about these four new iPhones that would compel people to go out and upgrade, downgrade, if they've got an expensive one and they want something more simple?
The thing that you have to remember, 5G is the selling point of this. It's all about the speed of that network. And that's what Apple is really going to be pushing as it promotes the iPhone 12. Now, other things that it's going to have, the entry-level phones they're good phones. They're better cameras. They have faster processors. The things that you would sort of expect from the generational upgrade in phones. But if you look at the higher end, the iPhone 12 Pro or Plus Pro, you're going to see a machine that has got a software for augmented reality built in, so you can see a bigger push of that coming. Really high-quality camera on this allows you to do post-production work after you've taken your picture. It uses HDR video, which gives you much crisper, brighter colors when you're shooting video. The downside of these phones, though, is Apple figures at this point, everyone has a charger at their house of some form. So there is no headphone, there is no charger included in the box this time, and that's going to probably tick off some people, but if you give it some thought, once you get past that initial, why isn't this in the box, it's not as big a deal as it seems. Because you already have a charger, probably from a previous iPhone, or you already have headphones from a previous iPhone. It's this cost-cutting measure for Apple, no question, but it's not something that is going to necessarily leave you high and dry once you take this phone out of the box.
Fortune tech reporter Chris Morris, thanks for being with us. Rapper and social political activist Killer Mike will receive the first Billboard Changemaker Award at the 2020 Billboard Music Awards tonight. The Atlanta-born Killer Mike first made waves in music with his appearance on Outkast's 2000 album, Stankonia. But Killer Mike has also made a lot of noise outside of music by speaking out against police brutality, inequality in Black communities, and race relations. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. If I
high Chevrolet Impala, peachy cream, cruising down the street like toothpaste, cause the ivory is clean. Talk about mean at the end, seam on the inside of the ship. Got a honey dip to hunt him, he's more blue than a for the Blue Man Group. Caught that on the Vegas Strip, hit him a good game, juju, in him. I'm at Boss Hip Hip Six, all next, Hip Hip Six, Hip Moments, that's it's a and that's for sure. My brain is on one track like Mary Mary thoughts, or like a roster does, but none of that, but the female, where is that? I'm a man, an ID man, a woman for that act. Personal preference, plus I use the law of nature as a reference. No, I don't ever recall seeing a man turn up pregnant, but that just me. Feminine female fantasy product freely in my, every 30-something seconds, I can't stop it. Okay.